G'day, g'day. You're listening to Jewels and Bullets, the You and My Discography podcast, a show where a You and My fan and a You and My super fan discuss each of the band's records. I'm Tommy Waits, an Aussie writer and podcaster who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm the You and My fan in the equation. My co-host and You and My super fan is Sydney-based Jono Duncan, the host of the Progressive Rugby League podcast and general man about town. Jono, how the bloody hell are you?
Doing pretty well, Tom. How are you, mate?
I'm doing good. I profusely apologize to Jono before this episode began because 2 weeks ago I dropped the ball. I dropped the rugby ball when I missed the scheduled recording for this very episode. And Jono, if you're not aware, is the nicest man in the world, and via email is like, no worries at all. But now we're on the mic, I want to just get clarity. Was there any part of it where you're like, fuck, was there any swears under your breath, any kicking of the bedpost when I didn't show up for our scheduled meeting 2 weeks ago?
Not really. It was just, the only thing was I was a bit bummed because I had because we do this at 6:30 a.m. Sydney time, and I think it's 3:30 p.m. Atlanta time. And I was just looking forward to doing something cool that day because I had a really shit work day coming up. I had a lot of tough meetings. I was like, oh, well, I was looking forward to the day because we had this on. So, and once this was canned, I was like, oh, it's just a shit day then. That's the only thing. So the silver lining was I had an extra week or two with Number Four Record. So,
yeah,
you know, it's always silver linings.
Yeah. Well, that felt pretty honest. I think there was probably at least one tub of motherfucker under your breath.
Yeah.
But, well, maybe we'll get to the truth one day. But, anyway, we're all good on a relationship level. And, as Jono mentioned today, it's episode 4, and we're talking Number Four Record from 1998. Before we dive in, the regular disclaimer: myself and Jono are in no way affiliated to UMI. We're just two fans talking music for the love of the game. If you found this show, there's a good chance you're already familiar with the group known as UMI. But if not, listen to their records, go to their shows, send them all your money and love. They bloody deserve it. Jono, you seem like the type of fella to read all the T's and C's before entering a meat raffle. How do you feel? How do you feel that disclaimer stacks up from a legal perspective?
It's rock solid, mate. I can't see it. It's watertight. I can't see any problems there. We won't be in a court anytime soon, I believe.
Fantastic. All right. Well, the format for this show will be as follows. We'll kick things off by discussing a little bit of what happened in the You and My world in the lead up to the recording of Number Four Record. Then we'll go through the record track by track. And finally, we'll talk about what happened after the album dropped. So, yeah, in terms of the kind of background on the record, we try and keep this stuff that you can't really wiki. And so just to kind of set the scene, the recording began in late 1997 with George Draculius, who's apparently a protege of Rick Rubin, LA super producer man. And it's, I guess, probably one thing that I just wanted to touch on was that compared to the 1-2 punch of Hi-Fi Way and Ali Daily, which I believe came out in consecutive years, right? That was 95 and 96. There was a 2-year break with this one between 96 Ali Daily and 98 Number Four Records. So I'm guessing that was because of a lot of touring on the back of Ali Daily. And I also just saw some, soundbite from Tim, or tidbit of a quote saying that the band wasn't talking at the time, and that probably infiltrated the studio recording sessions that kind of, probably just off the back of recording, spending too much time touring rather with each other. But that's all I really got out of, just trying to set the scene for this record. Jono, I'm sure you've got some more nuggets up your sleeve.
Yeah, well, I guess coming from Ali Daly, I think they're at their popular peak. They just had their second number one record, and I think they were trying to break into other markets, a lot of touring around Europe and the US. I guess we sort of got the hint towards the end of Ali Daly in that awesome doco that we mentioned in the previous episode that at the end of the process for Ali Daly, really from the mixing onwards, was when Tim and the band started to feel a bit of outside pressure about, you know, how to write songs, how to record songs. And from what I gather, it probably flowed into this period as well and the next record or two as well. So this is an interesting record from that perspective. But, you know, from a public perspective, the hype was up in Australia. They were in the middle of their sort of golden run from popularity. But for myself, this record is personal, you know, because over my lifetime,
This
is the album I've spent most time with overall, I reckon. And it's the first You're My album I got into. And, you know, on reflection, it was the first time in my life that I really remember experiencing the power of art, as lame as that sounds. When this album was playing at my house, I was transformed. I couldn't get enough of it. Couldn't wait to get home from school in Arvo and put it on and shake off the school day. I think I was addicted. I felt every line, every drum fill, just fell in love with it. And as I said in the first step, it was Heavy Heart that was my gateway drug. I won't repeat my UMI origin story, but perhaps a few dot points as a brief reminder to listeners. I was in year 10. This time in my life, I had a weird thing for talkback shock jock radio and got my music fixed from Triple M. I may have been on track to be a right-wing rat bag, but we'll never know. My older brother was giving me a lift to my work experience placement at a real estate agent in Carlingford, Sydney. He had Triple J Breakfast on, the Paul McDermott years. Heavy Heart comes on and I'm floored. I'd never heard anything like it. I'd never experienced a feeling like it. Don't think I have since. Probably won't again. From that moment, I gradually become the person you hear today, John O.P. Duncan. And I think my trajectory has indirectly and gradually, but heavily, been influenced by that morning with my brother in that car, the Ford Laser Bubbleback. So I guess that sets the scene a little, I guess, from where I'm coming from in terms of number four record. And I should add that while I spent more time with this record than any other before the last couple of weeks, I hadn't listened to it in ages. So I was looking forward to getting back into it. But I got to admit, the first time around, I was a bit deflated. It didn't really hit me the way I expected or wanted it to, I got to admit. But I went back to it, of course, and this time really turned it up loud, you know, cranked it. And let me tell you, you know, I was 14 again, you know, rocking out, the guitar and thigh slapping. It was immense. This album for me is funny in a way. I've heard people reference the sound of it. But for me, because it was my entry point and because it hit me so hard, I don't really hear it, you know, until the last couple of weeks. I don't really hear it the way people describe it. I've heard it described variously as, you know, a bit dirty, a bit seedy, a bit of a road album, a bit 60s maybe. You know, I get that. But in terms of what I have been hearing, I've just been hearing UMI because this is You Are My sound that I compare everything else to. It's my baseline. But in saying all that, and this is the beauty of doing this pod with you, Tom, it was fun to listen to this album fresh and try to see it from a different angle and a different chronology, like the actual chronology, listening to it fourth, you know, after Sound As Ever, after Hi-Fi Away, after Ali Daly. And I think I have been able to see it in a slightly different light and hear what others have heard and described. So, yeah, fantastic album. Their third number one in a row in Australia. So, yeah, let's get stuck in.
Yeah, well, let's before we jump to the track list, I can definitely relate to the origin story because my equivalent would have been Highly Evolved by the Vines. I heard Get Free on MTV. Oh, these guys are Australian. And then, yeah, and perhaps similar in that Get Free was kind of like a balls out rocker, but then the album was Highly Evolved is pretty varied. And so that would have been interesting for 14-year-old Jono, where you hear Heavy Heart and then you get number four record where it's all over the place. You get like varied sounds as opposed to lots of bands where you'll hear their hit single on the radio and then you get the record, and the record is disappointing because it's just kind of slight tonal variations on the hit single. So I think that perhaps allows a band to really kind of like capture you, particularly when you're young, when you kind of your musical palette is perhaps not that advanced yet, but then you see them going into all these different areas, you're like, wow, they can do it all. And so I can definitely imagine at that point in your life, considering the who you were and the picture you've painted of yourself, that why this came along and kind of became the You Are My Bassline for John O'Duncan.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think as a kid, and I think still it carries today, I'm wary of getting into things too much because, you know, I don't want to get sucked in. So in this case, I wasn't really looking to get into a band at all. Like music wasn't really that big in my life. And so I loved this song so much when I first heard it that I'd just go downstairs. And my brother had the album, luckily, and I just put on this track 8. And then I'd turn it off and go upstairs. And then I'd go back down and I'd put it on again, track 8, listen to it, you know, sing along. And then sort of sometimes...
Your parents are like, is there something wrong with John?
And then, you know, if I'd be away from the stereo and the track would finish, and then it would go into the first riff of Rumble. And so that's how I go, okay, this is interesting. And then just from there, like, it kind of gradually happened. I didn't really want to get into it, but, like, you know... After a while, you know, you just want to hear more. I've heard this song now. What else have we got? And so, over the next few weeks and months, you know, I gradually got through the rest of the album. But really, it started track 8 to track 12. And then, okay, I might just backtrack to track 1, see what track 1's got. So it was a weird kind of entry for me in this album. But now I'm able to listen to it fresh. So I think I've got a better grasp of it overall.
Nice one. All right, let's jump into the tracks. Track 1, Junk. Well, I guess I've got like an anecdote to talk about Junk, but John, I want to throw to you to kick things off. What are your thoughts about Junk?
Yeah, well, Junk, obviously a rockin' riff, and it's cool horns and some virtuosic bass moments from Andy Kent, and a real like swelling ending. Mm. And when you hear it live, you realize how dirty and rocking it is. And you don't see this live very often these days. I kind of wish I was around to see this song played live when it was first released. I reckon that would have been super exciting. But, yeah, I think a great way to start the album, you know, for a pile of trash, I sure smell sweet. That kind of sets the tone for the record in a way. It's kind of dirty and sweet simultaneously. So, yeah, the only thing I would perhaps change about this song is that the first riff, which is awesome, it seems like it's kind of muted at the start. I love that riff, so I'd love it as loud as possible. But great song.
So my Junk anecdote, I want to take you back to a magical time far, far away. It was about 2007, Busselton for the Southbound Festival, I believe. And that was always like, it's WA's equivalent of Falls Festival, and it happens right around like New Year's each year. So I'm not sure if it was like the brink of 2007 or the brink of 2008. It was, I know this because you and I were there playing one of the headliners, and they were playing songs from Convicts amongst with Greatest Hits. So I know it was that era. But anyway, it was the final afternoon, and young Tommy had gone a little too hard, and I was passed out in my tent at about, I don't know, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and really trying to rally myself for the last hurrah. I was dehydrated as fuck. I'd been drinking in the sun all day. I'd been there for 2 nights or something already, and just nonstop 24-hour party people type of vibe. And I remember my drug dealer at the time actually woke me up with a joint in my mouth, where I was kind of like in a fugue state between wake and sleep, and he saw I was struggling, and so rolled and lit a joint and then put it in my mouth as a little party present. But while he ventured off to go find his bliss with the headliner of choice, and because I was flat on my back, all my mates buggered off. And I think the plan was to, we'll go to Wolf Mother and we'll catch the end of UMI. The plan, because Wolf Mother were on the big stage, and then it was a slight crossover. So we're like, yeah, we'll get the last 20 minutes of UMI. Mm-hmm. And the joint did its thing. I was able to rally. But by that point, I'd lost all my mates that they'd gone off already. So I ventured into the Wolf Mother pit alone. At the time that I liked the band a lot. So I had a Nectar Disco Biscuit after I finished the joint. And so I was just in the Wolf Mother mosh pit, which, you know, when you think back to moments in your life, you'd like to get the kind of third person God perspective on how ridiculous it would have looked. But at the time I felt like I was, you know, Tolkien-esque imagery of Wolf Mother's lyrics and like, woman and all that shit. I felt like I was really in a battle with a bunch of other 19-year-olds in the mosh. But high as a kite, having the time of my life. And so anyway, Wolf Mother ended on a crescendo, probably the Joker and the Thief or some shit like that. Yeah. And then I stumbled across to the stage, the other stage where you and I were closing things out. I remember they played Gunslingers. I think I only caught like the last couple of songs. I remember seeing Gunslingers, which was fucking amazing. And then they ended with Junk. Oh. And it was very, very primal. And the way I describe it is that obviously the studio version has the horns to kind of augment the kind of rollicking, rocking groove. But live, they just kind of like, they added kind of like more grunts and kind of like, it was just more ramshackle where it kind of filled in the space where it, you know, some tracks where they have horns on the record, it never translates live. This was almost like a different beast, more animalistic and more kind of scary. And Tim was really on one that night where he was just, you know, shirtless, tats, I think a cowboy hat, swigging from a full empty bottle. And then, you know, the refrain of junk, 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 junk at the end. And then, you know, the final chord, and he just grabbed the mic and screamed, "Who's got coke?" And, I was obviously, a little impaired at the time. It was one of those moments where you're high and someone else wants to get high and you're like, yeah, this is great. And I think Tim's been pretty open with his, like, you know, the issue he had in Tasmania where he accidentally, donked Missy Higgins on the head and like, just being, a little impaired on stage. And he probably looks back on those moments with embarrassment. But I have to say, if you're a young punter in the crowd and you're looking for a rock and roll hero, he delivered that night tenfold. And the seeing Junk live in that atmosphere was incredible. And after they finished, I was kind of still letting it all wash over me. Then I saw, hey, Tommy, saw all my mates as well. So it was, got to hug it out with all my buddies and recap our respective Wolf Mother and UMI experiences. So, but yeah, this song is, sorry, mate.
I was just going to say, that's an awesome anecdote. Bustleton, geez, it's all happening in Bustleton.
Yeah,
responsible drug dealing too from your drug dealer, mate. You know, joint in the mouth. Are you okay? Here's a joint and you were better. That's just ideal.
Yeah, no, he was great. On you, Peter, if you're still listening. But just the tune itself, I think it's as far like the lyrics are, it's basically like being destitute, having absolutely nothing, but still feeling like a million bucks. And I don't know if that's rock. There's been times in my life where I felt down and out, but then the right song loud on your headphones, it can rejuvenate you and you think, no, fuck, I'm not finished yet. I'm going to turn this around and I might look like shit, but I'm going to make this work. So amazing track. Amazing track to kick things off. And just the only other thought I have on this tune is I saw a Triple J interview with Liam Gallagher from one of his Aussie tours a few years ago. They asked him his favorite Aussie song and he said, "Well, I said Junk makes me want to buy UMI, makes me want to hit things." So because I know around this era, I think it was probably after this record, they were touring with Oasis, and so
yes,
yeah, that's
were,
that,
there was a period when they toured with Oasis in Australia. Maybe it was before this period, maybe late 90s or something. And that was when Oasis was kind of, you know, all over the shop with their kind of the way they were getting along. And I think I remember a story that UMI supported Oasis. Then Oasis kind of combusted and kind of didn't play the show, or the show was truncated because of, I don't know, a fight or someone couldn't get to the stage or something. And then UMI kind of finished it off. I think that's a very vague recollection of a story, a third-hand story. But yeah, I think they have some history together, Oasis and the Gallagher brothers and Tim and UMI. So yeah,
sounds on brand for the Gallagher bros. But yeah, and so Liam Gallagher, fan of Rodgers and UMI, saw that he was actually on Liquid Lunch an interview a couple months ago or something.
Yeah, they both have been at various times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I think they both have had records out, both Liam and Noel, very short interviews and interactions. But yeah, they both have been on for their various records. So yeah,
that's actually what I was going to say. So Liam likes UMI, but also I read this, because growing up I was a massive Oasis fan, I read this book from it was like a photojournalist who went on tour with the Gallagher Bros, the Oasis band, and it was the part in Australia where the photojournalist, like, he Noel Gallagher said, "Oh, have you listened to any of UMI's albums?" And he's like, "Oh, it just sounds like the Jam to me." Where he was like, "Yeah, it's okay, but just kind of wrote it off." But apparently Noel Gallagher said, like, "No, go listen to it again." Yeah, wow. And like, I'm not sure which record it was, but insisted that this guy give him another chance, and it worked. The guy was like, "Yeah, Noel was right. They're fucking amazing." So, anyway, that's everything I can think of with Junk. What a way to kick the album off.
Yeah, absolutely. And we head into Cream in the Croc.
Baby.
An incredible one to follow. Similarly to Junk, seeing it live makes you realize how hard it goes. You know, Rusty, you know, takes center stage again in the middle of this tune. Some great lines within it too. You know, is it really so bad, or did you just want me to go? Hey, before you leave us by the side of the road, I want to tell you about the little I know. I've always wanted to say those lines to people, but I've never found the right context. They're peak rock and roll lyrics in my mind.
Yeah, and I think that I listening to this record in preparation for this pod made me realize that Ellie Daly, as we discussed in the last ep, is, you could call it, a close to perfect concept album. Whereas I think Number Four Record is kind of like an anti-concept album, where it's just like, hence the title, Number Four Record, like no pretense. Yep. Let's just, you know, it's kind of almost like a meta there. This is just what it is. These are just a collection of songs. And so I think that with Junk, you could almost be like, oh, are we still in concept album territory here? Is this going to be like, because Junk almost has kind of like a musical theater bombastic component to it, where you're like, oh, this is, are we going to see some dancing people with briefcase and some kind of like West Side Story pretend fights happening to Junk, like the Gallagher Bros, like in a Broadway musical? but then you kind of like, you slide into the Cream and the Croc, and for me it's the when that kind of lick rings out prior to the first chorus. I think that's when you can kick back and think, relax, there's nothing you need to figure out here. You don't need to figure out who's the protagonist, who's the supporting characters, what are the subplots. It's just a straight up and down rock and roll record. And I think that the kind of the lyrics, I found this on genius.com, because at the beginning of the song says, "Took a drag from something that I don't even smoke," and a line from something that some other guy wrote. And then later in the song, it goes, "Then meanwhile, I was there thinking," and this is from genius.com. "This lyric echoes a line from the Chuck Berry song, Little Queenie, from 1959. Tim Rogers' phrasing seems to draw particular influence from the Rolling Stones cover of Little Queenie as performed on their 1970 live album, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. So I think it's kind of like, this is your, my essentially getting very much back to the, we're a rock and roll band roots. And the line, and a line from the, from something that some other guy wrote, it's kind of like a, it's referencing a Rolling Stones tune that was originally like, so it's kind of like two other, because it was originally a Chuck Berry song. So there's levels,
Jeez, and, man, it's spinning, man.
Yeah. So, but anyway, and obviously the kind of overt Stonesy licks and kind of piano in the outro and around the chorus as well. So, yeah, as far as this is kind of like a, and a song built for the live arena, and I kind of think that it's almost like a, let's drop the concept album shit. We're a rock and roll band. Here are our best 12 songs of this year. Let's do this. So that for me, in a weird way, this kind of, this transition from Junk into track two symbolizes what I believe they were trying to go for with this record.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I have a kind of related question, I guess. You know, I've mentioned these first two songs, they really cut through once you hear them live. And I think I'll say this a few more times in this pod, that I prefer the live version. So if you think the live version kind of makes you realize how rocking it is, and if, is there something to be said about the production or the mixing, or maybe it's just that they were going for a certain sound for the album? You know, I guess a complex one, because if you're wanting to go for a certain sound, maybe there is an argument to hem it in a little. But on the other hand, don't you want all your songs to just flourish to their maximum? So I don't know what your thoughts are on that in terms of like making a record, or what people go for in general.
Yeah, I don't really. Yeah, I like, this is something I actually wanted to raise on track three, where I really like the song. And I think Tim has said himself with track three, it's like, it's one of the best things I've written. Where he said that at the time, but he wasn't happy with the way it came out. And so, because I had that kind of context listening to this album, I was trying to kind of analyze what is off with the production that's taking something away from the studio version that you'd get. And I can't really put my finger on it. Like, I can understand what people mean in terms of, like, compared to Hi-Fi Way. I think Hi-Fi Way is just has better production for those songs. And but I like these, like, for just to stay on the cream and the crop for a second. I like the song so much where if I turn it up loud enough, I don't care. If you know what I mean, because I think it's like this is an album that's designed to play live and play it loud. And if you listen to it quietly on your headphones, you can kind of nitpick over stuff. But if you play it loud, it still works. And to answer your question, or at least the point that you raised, that kind of like one of the things that I've noticed about Tim in recent years, he's referred back to the 90s where he feels embarrassed or ashamed about how he behaved, because he says he was too ambitious, or like he kind of took things for granted in his life, or was like too headstrong about striving towards success. And I've always wondered what that translated to in terms of like, what, you know, was he a dickhead to be around, or was it kind of like choices that he made of like producers to work with and things like that? And so I don't really know, like maybe there was kind of like a willingness to try and like go along with this like LA producer and like do his kind of ideas to the record, as opposed to like staying true to the roots and all that. But I don't really know, because I think it could be produced better, but I have no idea what that would look like. I have no real idea what was off with this. I just know it's perhaps not produced as well as like Hi-Fi Way was for that particular batch of songs.
I agree. I think in terms of Hi-Fi Way, it just tends to pop and fizzle a bit more. And the maybe on this particular album, when they put the horns in, for some reason, it sometimes subdues the song compared to Ali Daly, for whatever reason. The horns were really kind of front and center when they came on, and they really kind of jumped out of the speakers. So yeah, I can't put my finger on it either, but don't know how the knobs and the all that sort of stuff works. But yeah, and I think in terms of Tim's how he sees himself in the 90s, I guess it hopefully kind of mellows a bit and he's not too hard of himself as he gets older. But yeah, I can imagine a time where, you know, there was a period where, you know, you could rock, being a rock star was kind of like the ultimate in culture, I guess. It's not really the same these days. And so I can imagine a situation, I've got no idea if this is true, but like, you know, there are record executives going, oh, you are the next big thing, Tim. You're gonna be huge. You know, you're a great songwriter. We just need to get you with the right producer. And then I guess, you know, that can manifest in a few different ways. You know, he can be annoyed at every little mistake that comes up, or can be a bit tense in the recording studio, or when a live show doesn't go well. Like, I guess I'm just kind of imagining what it could come down to, and he might be reflecting, thinking, oh, yeah. Because I've heard him also say, you know, subsequently, like, thank goodness we didn't become big, because who knows what that would have done to us or me. And so, yeah, I guess that this level of kind of popularity and sort of notoriety probably worked out best, I guess, in terms of like their overall health and friendships and relationships. So, yeah, complex one.
Yeah, definitely. It was on that YouTube channel I shared with you where they replay a bunch of their performances on like live shows from recovery and things like that from the 90s. And one of the comments was this Sheila, who's probably like in her 50s now, whatever, was like, oh my God, you and my, in the 90s in Australia, they were our Beatles. And it was something that I kind of knew already, but like just seeing it written out, I was like, oh yeah, they must, you know, this era, Hi-Fi Way, Ali Daly, Number Four, they were, you know, the biggest band, and they were kind of like right on the cusp of like alternative and like pop. And in a place like Australia with only like, you know, 20 million people at the time, that would have been intense pressure and confusing about trying to figure out where you fit into the broader arts landscape. Do I stay in my comfy little hovel that we've created in Australia? Do we crack the big time? And like, and even if you make that decision to be ambitious and like, no, we should do it, we should be the next NXS or Men at Work or whatever, that's, I guess, easier said than done. Like, how do you, maybe they were kind of trying to do this by working with this guy in LA, but then you don't want to alienate your existing audience anyway. But anyway, let's move on. Track three, What I Don't Know About You. Jono, What I Don't Know About You.
I love this song. The song title, I believe, came from Tim's friend or girlfriend at the time. And it's a beautiful pop chorus and a kind of a shimmering pop song in a way, even though lyrically it's a little gloomy. But to me, the concept of the main line of the song, you know, I think I like what I don't know about you. It's really sweet and evokes a warmth in me. It's basically saying, I know things probably aren't great with you. They're definitely not that great with me. But how about we get to know each other, which I think is really sweet. But anyway, there's also a beautiful acoustic version from the Live at the Wireless recording, which didn't make the bonus CD of this album. So the bonus CD has 9 tracks, goes for 29 minutes from memory. But I heard the What I Don't Know About You version when Triple J did a long weekend Live at the Wireless thing, a decade or two ago. And they played the UMI set from this period. UMI's done, you know, a bunch of Live at the Wirelesses over the years. This one's my favorite. And I taped this onto cassette and just fell in love with Tim's solo version of What I Don't Know About You. But unfortunately, I've lost that tape somewhere along the line and haven't heard that version in years, probably a decade or more. So that's a bit sad. But I could probably find it somewhere, but I'm not very good with technology. So what do you do? But this whole day was useless. The next one's going to be worse. What's the line to start the song? But it's a... What a line to start a really shimmering pop song.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's really beautiful. And I've said this already a bunch on this podcast, but the songwriting here reminds me a ton of Crosby, Stills and Nash and the Byrds. It sounds kind of like San Francisco in the 60s and Free Love. It's kind of like a hippie refrain in a way. I think I like What I Don't Know About You. Like it's kind of like astral planing the future and everything's going to be cool, man. And like it feels like a warm hug. And I feel like, yeah, this is one where the production is a little off. Like I think if they'd done something slightly more grainy, it would have evoked a bit more kind of that retro 60s kind of vibe. Whereas I think it sounds a little too like pop rock, capital P, capital R, where it's like, again, I like the song so much, I can overlook my 5% griping with the only thing. This is one of the few tracks I can actually pinpoint what I don't like. Like the solo, I don't mind the solo, but the tone of the lead guitar and the solo, it sounds like a pedal where it just says like solo, like a little too generic for and just kind of sticks out not in a good way. That's me griping here, but
it's a 5% like, gripe.
It's a 5% gripe, which I think is pretty good. So it's definitely not a full bullet. It's still a jewel. Yeah.
It's a really good solo too.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's why it's getting the 5% gripe, because it'll be like, oh, slightly different tone, but let's blame it on this George fella, the Ruben protege. But for me, some of the best lyrics he's ever written. The sky's so heavy, it hangs like a beer gut. And perhaps my favorite line, if I got faith, why am I so scared of everybody dying on me? And I don't know if you've seen the music video, but it's kind of like a Don's Party rehash, or just kind of like Stephen Curry and Ben Mendelsohn are pretending. They're pretending to be characters from Don's Party, and the band are playing in the background, and Andy and Rusty are kind of like getting into the swing of things, and like Andy's dressed up and like pretending to be one of the party guests, but like Tim looks infuriated the whole time, and so that adds a little special something there to the music video, where he just doesn't seem happy to be a part of whatever's going on. So
that is a good video. That I think What I Don't Know About You ended up being their highest charting single, I'm pretty sure, overall, like in, I don't know, the high 20s or something. So it kind of was a very much a single vibe, but lyrically though, for a single, it's very interesting. It's an interesting story about those two people and what they're kind of observing at the time. And it is quite gloomy, as I said, but in a way the tone of the chorus kind of takes me, it's that kind of warm feeling. It takes me to that feeling that you only really experience once or twice in a lifetime, when you're getting to know someone really well and you're kind of connecting so well with that person that you're seriously considering that this person and this relationship might actually be perfect. Of course, like as you get older, you realize human perfection doesn't exist. And you enter relationships a bit more wary, but when you're young, anything seems possible. So that sort of like thing, oh my God, this moment, this interaction is absolutely perfect. That kind of evokes that in me.
Yeah, it's really, really sweet sentiment, and captured perfectly with the song. Track 4, 15. Well, yeah, if you like the way track 3 kicks off, 15 has an amazing opening line as well. Oh, yeah. Hey, it's your friends. it's kind of awesome how, because What I Don't Know About You, and perhaps this is like the music video, which I swear I've seen over the years, like that must have been planted in my brain somehow. And so What I don't know about you is kind of like, yeah, things are great, Rosie and the new. It's kind of, that's the type of track you'd play like when you're inviting your new girlfriend to meet your mates for the first time. They're like, oh, that Brendan friend of yours is pretty fun. And then like 2 weeks later, she's like, hate your friends because Brendan keeps giving you drugs or something. Like it's, and so I think they're kind of, it's an interesting, interesting 1-2 punch.
Yeah, that's right. And I think originally the title, I think the working title for this track was Fuck the Kids. But you're right. Opening line, hate your friends because they're the only ones that make you want to die. There's quite the insight there. Rockin' tune. And once again, goes very well live. There's a great version on Saturday night round 10. It sort of poses the question to me that, you know, in terms of song titles, does it make a difference? You know, would this be a cult classic if it was remained named Fuck the Kids? At the moment, 15 is kind of like a pretty bland sort of name for a song. But, you know, if you had like I'm just curious about like names and titles and things, whether they make a big difference. It doesn't make a difference to the quality of the song. The quality of the song is very high. But, like, would it make a difference to people's kind of perception? Oh, how good's Fuck the Kids? Just because it like gives them a bit of a rush to say Fuck the Kids. You know what I mean?
How good's fucking kids? Oh, I just got us banned on YouTube. Sorry, mate. Yeah, no, I this is something I've wondered about a lot as well. There's some Aussie band, Parcels, who are based out of Berlin, I believe, and they do something with interesting with it. They just have like... at least they did for the first album or maybe the second, just only one word titles. And I don't know, there's some type of stylistic choice where I think they, everything's in capitals except the first letter or something. But yeah, but you rarely see bands put much thought or effort into titles, I think. And at the detriment, because I agree, a good title that actually encapsulates the nature of the song or what's going on, it can elevate it, or it's perhaps almost just like a post-it note for your brain a little bit.
Yeah.
Where if you're looking for a track to put on, if a song has been well titled, it's just going to jump out at you a little bit quicker as opposed to more bland titles that don't necessarily represent the song that well. So yeah, I agree that maybe for this one, 15 was a bad choice.
I've just realized my naivety there, because your reaction to Fuck the Kids, yeah, that might have been a bad choice to include there. Maybe like a comma in there, fuck comma the kids, or no, I don't know. Either, I think it was a good choice in hindsight to not name it that.
Totally, yeah, but there's a happy medium perhaps. FTK, refer to it from here forward, is on one level of the screen. So you got FTK over there, and then you've got 15 over here. Maybe there's somewhere in the middle. There's a bunch of other words, but I really like this tune. And for me, the opening riff, I think it's a little Battle of the Bands, but for me, so which is, to be clear, not a good thing. It's a bit of like, yeah, here we go. We've got you and my year 10, like, da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. And the Battle of the Bands band would keep singing over that riff. Something about, I don't know, guys, girls, and guitars, perhaps. And that would be the whole song. But you and I do that. And then it makes the beginning of it, the first lyric, the first refrain, so much more impactful, because it's kind of like, it's more jarring. So I like, to be clear, I like the Battle of the Bands little bridge thing when it's used later in the song. I think it fits a lot more. But at the start, it kind of like, it's a pinprick or something. You're like, ow, that hurts my ears a little bit. But I think it's clever because it's... The kind of croon of the first verse has more, it just sounds more sophisticated to me, just due to the fact that they have the kind of that riff at the beginning. So I really like that they've done that.
Yeah, and just coming out of what I don't know about you as well, it kind of is a good counterpunch to that. So
yeah, definitely punchy. And the actual verse, I guess it's kind of got like a 50s love song kind of vibe about it. It reminds me, I'm not sure if you've ever seen that movie from the 90s, That Thing You Do, directed by Tom Hanks, where it's about a band. It's the simplest movie of all time. It's like, I'll break down the plot. Let's start a band. We wrote a song. We got a show. We're on the radio. We got signed by a record label. We've got a number one hit single. We're breaking up. That's the whole movie in a nutshell. And Tom Hanks is just kind of looking surly in the background as the manager the whole time. So, but anyway, in that movie, they've got this song, That Thing You Do, where it's like this 50s style love song with the kind of the drumming reminds me of it. And as far as the kind of the lyrics and I guess the takeaway here, as far as I can gather, it's about kind of feeling suffocated by your social life or something. Like the lyric, the ones who shine so bright are made or broke come Friday night. Like the weight of expectation of social interaction or kind of like, am I on the right track in terms of the lyrical content?
Yeah, I think so. Like, you know, when you're in your teens and like, for me, definitely social interactions took a lot out of me, and I thought too much about them, and I pondered about them too much afterwards. And so, yeah, I get that sense as well, a bit of claustrophobia about all that kind of social scene that you go through. And some people, it's just effortless. But some people, it's like a big effort and a big pain. Yeah, I get that feeling.
All right, track 5, Top of the Morn, Slip of the Day. Jono, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, this one was a grower for me, and now it's one of my favorites. So I just love the chord progression for that intro. It just hits me for some reason. It's like, and I don't know why, but I just love hearing it. It goes for about 40 seconds. First tinge of country on the album too, I'd say. I'd also say made the words Take Me Out cool before Franz Ferdinand. So yeah, good track. I think a really solid middle of the album track, and a good link from those first tracks into the rest of the album. It kind of like a bit more of a okay, sit down. Okay, this is an album that I want to spend time with. This is like a good song to kind of go, okay, here's the album as a whole. Take stock, enjoy it. Enjoy the rest of the album. This is how I see it.
Yeah, for me, this is falls into the category of like I'm tired of being on the road tune, where you perhaps get like it feels autobiographical. You feel like you're getting kind of a window into what it was like to be Tim or the other guys in the band during the kind of hourly daily tour. Cycle that 2 year period. So it feels like I said before, where it feels like it's coming from the heart, and it doesn't it just, like you said, it got that country tinge, and it's kind of like it's that You and My flexing kind of their chops and like going in a different direction, and it it's kind of very different from the two tracks before it.
Yeah, like Shuffle Around the Earth Like a Ping Pong. It kind of takes you there straight away about what their lives are like at that point in time. So, yeah, great tune.
And I think I know, but what is the Top of the Morn and the Slip of the Day?
Oh, got no idea. What is Top of the Morn? Isn't that just like a Top of the Morn to you? I don't know.
So the Top of the – like, yeah, so kind of like – yeah, but what's the Slip of the Day then?
Good question.
Is it kind of like you're the day kind of just slipping away?
I guess is it dusk? Is like dawn and dusk, Top of Morn, Slip of Day? Because Slip of Day, don't feel good since you've been away. So here's to you. So maybe it's kind of just end of the day and kind of
time passing.
Reflections yeah. at the end of the day, I guess. Maybe. Happy to be corrected by etymologists, our students listening.
Yeah, please write in. All right, track six, Billy. Yeah, my little boy's named Billy, so this was but this wasn't kind of like I'd name my kid Billy after this track, but yeah, I really like this one. I feel like Jet based their entire career off this tune.
Oh, right, yeah.
No, just in terms of the early, well, I guess there's only a couple, three Jet albums, but for me, they're kind of like, just picturing this moment in time, Jet Boys would have been like in high school hearing this and being like, well, yeah, this is just kind of like a beat rocker, and their early songs sound a lot like this. And I can also picture, my note here is like, I imagine a young Davey Lane getting around his suburb listening to this as well, like on his BMX bike or something, really vibe into this in his head.
Wanting to play the rhythm guitar track on it and get the kind of the rhythm of the strum perfect and everything.
Because
I was doing that but in an air guitar. That's hard enough as an air guitarist, let alone an actual guitarist. But yeah, cool track. Once again, I'd probably say the live version probably wins out the live at the Wireless that I mentioned. House is a great version. I think I like it mostly because Tim delivers a well-timed F-bomb at the end that just sounds really cool. And sometimes that can make all the difference. But yeah, I mean, following on from what we've said, it would be a great album to see played live, you know, right the way through. Not that I necessarily want to see that kind of thing, but that kind of thing has been done. But if it ever becomes cool again, I'd be up for it. Because, you know, whenever they play a number four record song live, you know it's going to come off real well. So it's being played live, you know, road album of sorts. So it makes sense, I guess. But, yeah, Billy, he's the man without a plan. Fun times. Is your son a potential man without a plan?
As the early evidence would suggest, he's definitely he's definitely winging it. So yeah, I'll play this in the car on the way to school tomorrow and see.
This could see be if you, it hits the spot.
Yeah, exactly. All right, track seven, "Come Home With Me." This is kind of another little romantic number. Jono, what are your thoughts?
I do like it. This is obviously when starting at track eight. As I did with Heavy Heart, this is the last song I came to. So, it was a closer for me for many years. but yeah, cool live version, again, recorded by Triple J, I think from the Falls Festival, maybe. Again, I'd probably lean towards that live version from this track, but not to say that I don't really like the recorded track too. I think Ben Montench, who I think is a founding member of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, he's playing on this song, I believe. There's a nice key solo as well, which is really cool. There's horns and the keys work really well. So not to say I really love the album version, but yeah, once again, the live version, it adds a little edge to it, and it sounds Tim kind of riffs at the end, and it's a great tune, actually, a pretty rocking tune.
Yeah, and also we've discussed this before, but some people say Tim Rogers' voice is limiting, but you know, on this particular track I think he nails it. And it's got that kind of swooning effect. Love the kind of organ during the breakdown section. And I again kind of like just a nice little surprise in the middle of the album where it feels like from a songwriting perspective they're not the concept album of Ali Daily, where it was like planned out a little bit, at least the sequencing in terms of goes to here. And there's like a story of the day happening with this. It's kind of all over the place in a good way. It's just kind of letting the songs shine on that stand, live and die on their own accord. And so, I love Tim's voice in this one. And I think it's a cool track.
Yeah. I'm with you.
All right, one of the biggies in terms of the UMI catalog, track 8, Heavy Heart. Jono, you've given us little Teaser, you've given us the bullets in terms of your heavy heart relationship with the with your origin story. Well, what else can you kind of add to it?
Well, what more can I say about this song? I know. I'm going to go through it line by line. All right, are you ready?
Get out your acoustic guitar. Let's have a cover.
Yeah, I'm just going to
say our own Live at the Wireless.
Yeah, but I mean, I'll be brutally honest. I was tempted to go through it line by line because there's so many great lines in this track, and I think that's one of the things that drew me in. I was like, oh my god, I miss you like sleep. Oh wow, I've never heard like it referred to like that. Nothing romantic about the hours I keep. I don't know what that means, but wow, yeah, it sounds great. And all day, morning hairdo that no comb can get through. You know, there's so many great lines. Talk a lot about football, etc., etc. My favorite, the kicker. It's just a low rent paying, palpitating pulp inside my shirt. I think the best description of a broken heart in history. I remember hearing the gentle strum to finish that song for the first time. As I said, I was in the Ford Laser bubble back with my brother, and it took my breath away. I sat there in my brother's car, just stunned. The perfect ending to the song. I remember Tim talking about this song that I think he was going for a Charlie Rich vibe. Did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? I didn't get it at the time, but I think 25 years later, I hear it now. Other thing I'll say about the song, great live version on Saturday night round 10, electrified version. Another version that comes to mind, excuse me, was at a solo gig of Tim's at the Annandale Hotel on one New Year's Day. It was solo with Shane O'Mara, who's an amazing guitarist, and a really interesting and experimental version, a bit noisy, a bit experimental. You didn't really recognize it as Heavy Heart until kind of near the end. So, I think that was appreciated by those in attendance that night. So, Heavy Heart for me, it's still, when I hear it in the right mood, in the right context, it still takes me back to that first feeling. So that's, I think, a sign of an extremely high-quality tune. Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost tough to talk about this because it's, at least for Australians into alternative music, it's kind of like one of the staples, and lots been said about it. It's kind of ubiquitous, but for me, it's one of those songs where I need to be careful when I listen to it because it does kind of get me almost every time. And it does remind me of the moments where I've had my heart broken before. And I was thinking kind of like in terms of praising the song, if I was going to, like, for example, my boy, as he gets older, I'm not sure if you'd ever ask this, but if you said, what's it like to get your heart broke? Like, what does it feel like to have your heart broken? I'd play him this song. Like this feels, I would imagine someone of any age could kind of like imagine, oh, this is like, it's, this is like a, I don't know, bit whether this even matters, whether you should talk about the music in isolation, but, one of the few times in the music videos, one of the very few times in his life, Tim Rogers seems to be like a little bit pudgy around the face, and he seems so fucking sad in the music video. Yeah. And I know around this time there was a breakup going on, which makes sense considering this song. So,
In that music video, UMI released the Cream, during the Cream of the Croc era, they released a DVD, to coincide with that double album best of release. And so the DVD was like, snippets of, it was all their music videos up till that point, a lot of live versions. I think that was basically it. And they had a kind of, director's commentary or band commentary over, when in DVDs they used to have kind of commentary over like the films and stuff. They did this over the film clips where the band just sit there and kind of watch the film clips and go, oh yeah, I remember doing this or whatever. And with this particular one, I remember Tim saying something like, oh yeah, we were told to kind of you know, pander eyes straight into the camera, and it was like a really kind of tough grind. But like, he put it off pretty well.
He conned me then. Well, I'm almost, that makes me feel a little bit better, because if he actually was going through it at the time, then I'd be like, oh, you looked really sad. I was, motherfucker. Like, so maybe he was he's being a thespian, perhaps.
Maybe, I'm sure. You know, you're sort of as an actor, you're sort of reaching for your for those experiences. So I'm sure it was authentic.
Yeah, I also, Tim Rogers said something once, I can't remember where I heard this or read it, but he was like, yeah, it's like my, you know, one of my most popular songs, and then I included that dumb waterlogged ball line, which will mean no one will cover it, and which I can't, you know, maybe now pop artists, because I guess he was probably referring to like a big pop, you know, performer, like, I don't know, Delta Goodrum or someone, like, doing an acoustic version, like, you know, to earn a bunch of change with the royalties or something. Like, I guess once upon a time, but I swear now people would, you wouldn't mind the waterlogged ball line, but maybe he was just being self-deprecating. But I guess just to kind of round things out, like, similar to you, I've encountered a few good live versions of this one. There was like a live big day. I remember showing this to you when we were, it was like your final night when you were visiting me in New York City. Mm-hmm. We were like at my apartment. I was like, oh, check out this live version of Heavy Heart. It was when like you and I were playing a side stage at the big day out, and they did a really like punky Stooges-esque version.
Yeah.
I remember you'd had a couple cans. You're like, Tommy, mate, I don't care what anyone says. They're the best band in the world. Like you're kind of like getting all emotional. I was like, yeah, I know, man. Let's go have some fun. And I had to pull you away from the YouTube before we went down the rabbit hole. But so that's really good. That's kind of the Stooges-esque punky version. Then when I saw them live in LA, they did kind of like a very ethereal, atmospheric version, which sounds perhaps was like in the ballpark of the one that you saw with old mate Shane, was it? I forget. That's it. And and then I guess the only other one that springs to mind was a big day out in Perth I went to, where Tim, I think Tim was there with you, but then also Tex was there, and they were doing the Tim and Tex shows. And so almost similar to my Southbound experience. I've just ravaged from a day in the sun and lots of substances. And so Tim and Tex were just like in a tiny tent, not even a side stage, like one of the smallest stages at the festival. And there were literally like me and my mates and like 15 other people in the tent. So it was amazing. And Tim and Tex did this tune, and I loved it because in Tex's verse, he said, instead of I'm thinner than I should be, he said, and I'm bigger than I should be. And I related to that, because when I've been sad and depressed, I tend to puff up as opposed to. Right. And I was like, yeah, mate, you're doing it for the big boned lassies as well, like me. I didn't heckle that, thank God. But anyway, that was very tender and sweet. And obviously, the man loved the tangible man love between Tim and Tex was a sight to behold as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I've read both Tim and Tex's autobiographies that came out over the last, I don't know, 5 years or so. And Tex definitely references this period where they made a record together, a very good record, lots of great tunes on them, a bit of fun as well. And I saw them once at the Annandale Hotel. And Tex sort of intimates that it kind of got a bit weird, and they maybe spent too much time together after a while. Like they couldn't stand the sight of each other. But you know, time heals, and I think they're still, you know, really close friends and stuff. But yeah, I think it was a really cool period where two of the greats of that, over the last 20, 30 years, collaborated together. And there's a funny anecdote I remember from that period, actually, where Tim, I think they were having a radio interview, and Tim was talking about the process of collaboration with Tex, because Tex is like a big collaborator. He loves like working with other people and sort of bouncing ideas, and he has that kind of personality, where Tim, you know, generally a bit more introverted, I guess, and does things by himself. And so when they were in a writing room together, Tim's like, is, you know, they were kind of writing a song together, and Tex is like, yeah, this is collaboration. It's like, this is collaboration. Are we collaborating? This is collaboration. yeah, this is collaboration. Oh, okay, cool. I've never really done it before. So yeah, interesting period.
Yeah, I haven't gone in depth on that, but I remember there was one tune of theirs that I really liked, Half or Nothing.
That was one of Texas, which
is a really sweet tune that they did together. So maybe we'll get into all the solo and spin-off stuff one day. But all right, that's Heavy Heart, track 9, Rumble. Jono, let's get in the car. Let's go for a ride.
Yeah. Well, look, once again, I would say, I feel like I'm shitting on the recorded versions, but I'd say the live version probably wins. But that's not to say that there isn't a great charm to the album version. You know, it sounds like it's coming out of your 60s car radio. And I guess that's what they're going for. Similar to Billy in a way, similar sound. And a thigh-slapping drum beat from Rusty. This is probably a good time, Tommy, to confess that I embarrassed myself quite a lot in my teens and my early 20s and probably later by slapping my thighs a lot. And hard, you know, in public, to Rusty's drumming, you know, trains, buses, uni lecture theatres. If my hands were free, they were slapping thighs. The feels in Rumble got to work out. You know, the cream of the crock unfurling too. The beat to Minor Bird, as we discussed a couple of eps back. The start to Baby Clothes and Wally Raffles. You know, I'm surprised my thighs survived, if I'm honest. But this is definitely a song where the feels in the middle, you know, just they beg to slap some thighs, you know, and I'm talking about my own thighs here. I'm not trying to be tricky with my language here to have some sort of windows. I'm slapping my own thighs. I'm like a crazy person on a train.
You're trying to get ahead of the Me Too that's coming your way. You're trying to say it was the band, man. The band made me do it.
Yeah, no, I would, you know, sometimes you're on the train or something, you see someone getting into their music, you know, a bit too much. You're like, okay, mate. But that was me.
Okay, mate. Yeah, well, you know, there's Dr. Fiona Stanley over in the West who helped all the Bali bombings with all their skin stuff after that tragedy. I think maybe she needed to take a look at your thighs after this album came out. Was there any skin left? But I'll always take a thigh slapper over a Hummer any day of the week.
Yeah, so public transport.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad you confessed that. But there's nothing worse than a Hummer, or even just like the person who will hum to, you know, just to themselves to fill in a bit of dead air. I can't stand that. So I'll take I might even join in if you got a good beat going on the thighs. I might tag in myself. But yeah, no, I love this tune. For me, I think that when you see there's a YouTube live performance where they're playing the St. Kilda Festival, which I've been to, which is a fun time down on St. Kilda Beach. I didn't go this particular year, but you and I seem to be headlining. It's kind of like at dusk, and they launch into the set with Rumble and to make like just the mix on that particular concert is great, and it's kind of a little bit more sloppy than the recorded version, and just kind of more chaotic. And but I agree, I kind of the backing vocals and the kind of like the call and call and respond type of thing that's going on here, I think is kind of it's awesome, and it's obviously kind of the sequencing is kind of genius and hilarious. You're down in the dumps with the Heavy Heart, and it's like, all right, stop, suck, get in the fucking car. Let's go find a new girl who'll break your heart in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So, just an amazing kind of rock and roll number, which I, as a young man, I used to listen to music like this, upbeat rockers, over and over and over again. It never got old. My palate has expanded. I listen to lots of different styles of music now and different tempos and blah, blah, blah. But yet, even though I don't listen to this type of tune as much as I used to, when I'm running or I need that kind of bit of pep. I've had too much caffeine, but I need some more pep. Throw on a Rumble and it does the job. So,
That's a good point. Like, I think that is something, you know, we'll talk about this in ensuing episodes, I'm sure. We won't get into it too much here, but what makes you and I, you know, different? You know, because in some ways, you know, people just go, they're just another rock band. In some ways, yeah, they are, but they're different in many ways. And one of them is that kind of upbeat tempo that and enthusiasm that they can generate that no one else, you know, not many other bands can kind of match. It's kind of like, let's have fun, what they're saying with their music and the kind of vibe that they're emanating. So I think Rumble's one of those songs that definitely kind of, you know, gets you excited and sort of happy to be alive kind of thing. So, yeah.
The one of the takeaways from Detours, Tim's book, the couple very sweet little passages where he's talking about his relationship with Davey Lane and their kind of on the road mantra of like, thank God there's a show tonight or whatever, something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing, and you can kind of tell all the guys in the band, but specifically Tim and Davey, really give it shit when it's time to perform. And whereas I think a lot of bands, particularly as they get older, the ravages of touring, their onstage persona, sometimes comically, and it kind of works, they lose energy and they kind of it's less intense than it used to be. Whereas I think band like You and My, they will continue to kind of push it. And that's something that, because you can listen to the early songs and they do still do what they're meant to. You don't have to reappraise the kind of, you don't have to look at these kind of high energy songs in a different light as the band gets older. They still get after it, which is appreciated. Track 10, Guys, Girls, Guitars. For me, this is kind of like another deconstruction of rock and roll anti-concept album song on this particular album.
Yeah, I think in this song, it's kind of like, for me, the lament of the rock and roll merry-go-round, perhaps. I don't know, like the seventh floor just keeps getting older. I don't know what it's about, but that's kind of how I see it. But, I think a cool sort of album track. Love the harmonies near the end. Don't have much to say about it, but saw it live for the first time a few years ago, I think. And, it worked really well, as all these songs do. And I think it has that kind of almost exhaustion feel to it of, you know, we've been on the road for a while and, you know, I'm exhausted. I'm dizzy. I don't know what you think about it.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of trying to, and this is something we can kind of get into with the post album, but I was trying to think about like, what is the vibe of this album? And I was like, the words that sprung to mind were like exhausted, but still ambitious. And so I don't know, with this song, and it's easy, you can kind of look back because you know what the trajectory of the band was, and so who knows how much of this was actually intentional, but for me, I think that like, at a certain point, being in a band and writing songs, you must kind of like start questioning your process or kind of like the reason you're doing it or like what, and you know, I saw that like Lou Reed, initially Lou Reed was kind of like he composed songs for kind of like commercials, I believe. He wrote like little pop songs. He was like a songwriter for hire, but then he did like his art rock thing. And then like, but essentially he kind of landed on, for Lou Reed, he was like trying to make pop music, which was supposedly frivolous and throwaway, have like literary merit. And so he was going to like bring in like some serious, and that's kind of like his songwriting was. But then eventually that even got thrown out and he did like Metal Machine Music in Berlin, where it was all kind of like noise and kind of like, because he seemed like he was attacking himself. He got sick of the, even though he was successful in crafting like these really popular songs, Lou Reed songs, then he got sick of it. So I feel like in this song, it's almost kind of like Tim Rogers questioning like, what am I doing? Why am I Yeah, and just kind of the seventh chord keeps getting older, and just kind of it's a sense of kind of disenchantment, but also being more like, this is my lot in life. I have to stick it out now. So that's the sense I get from this. But yeah, cool song. I like how it all comes together, and I dig it. Track 11, Plans.
Plans. Awesome tune. Really takes you straight to some of those suburban parties we all attended in our youth, and just the feeling that kind of anything could happen, you know. Tim's guitar solo, I think, perfectly suits this tune too. But I love the way the song starts in a kind of measured way. It's kind of metronomic, and then it kind of rushes you straight into the thick of it. You know, like, there's a street life each night, your heart at the deck. This drink says I love you. This drink says couldn't care less. You know, such a cool tune. And you feel like the sleaze and the grime as this story unfolds with, you know, chatting up for other people's girlfriends and whatever. It's a great tune.
Yeah, I had the same thought. It reminded me of the lament of the white male podcaster. Things were different before phones. You know, just the what does it, meet me at the sign?
We're all plans are made by mobile.
The Goodyear sign. Yeah, that's right. And just kind of like that's you'd obviously have the landline. You could call people up and be like, all right, let's meet here. Then you'd venture out into the world, and then if things changed, then there was no way to commit, hence every Seinfeld episode. But chaos ensues. But and this is like another kind of like little Tim story. I remember when I saw them, it was their own show, Metro's Fremantle, for the Convicts tour. They ended the show with Thank God I've Hit the Bottom, extremely aggressive punk song, and then Tim didn't seem to be bothered by the crowd, seemed to be in good spirits throughout the duration of the set. But then at the very end, kind of like threw his guitar on the ground and started yelling at someone in the crowd, grabbed the microphone and said, I'm going to steal your fucking girlfriend. And then had to be restrained by the other members of the band. And so it was, again, he might look back on those moments and be, you know, have a different perspective of what was going on. Maybe not. Maybe it was like, that guy was a dickhead and he deserved it. But for me, the 19-year-old in the crowd, whatever I was like, yes, this is what I came for. There was the cherry on top after a perfect show. Anyway, just that kind of lyric plans where it's late and she's Sue, because I read it on the back of her boyfriend's neck. All right. It kind of reminded me of Stealing Boyfriends, one of his locked and loaded lines, it seems.
All right.
Track 12, Closer, .. and Vandalism. Jono, close us out.
Another perfect way to finish an album, I reckon. It's a bit reflective. It's a bit melancholy. It's an album that has lived pretty hard, so it's really the perfect tune to get us home, hopefully, in one piece, you know. I know this guy, if I'm the mayonnaise and he's the cream, you know, another great opening line to this track. But, yeah, and it kind of fades out at the end, and you kind of get to the sense, oh, yeah, okay, cool. Like I can relax now, you know. We've been through it. It was a good time. Jesus, a fun night. But, this is the end. So it kind of works beautifully.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this song. And just kind of like reviewing the lyrics line by line, it seems to be about a guy who's jealous of someone else, or kind of like at least feeling aspirational towards him, like it can make a Wednesday morning feel like a Friday night. And it got me thinking. I was like, who's Tim writing about? Is this about Bernard Fanning? Like, is this Tim the mayonnaise and Fanning's the cream, or is the guy from Something for Kate the girl? Because I'm thinking like, or because it's almost like what I like about it is that the the storyteller in the song, he's kind of realizing that he's the mayonnaise and this guy that he's this other artist who's seemingly like doing a better job than he is getting more success, and like his girl's spending all his money, he's doing 3 gigs a night. But the line that I really like is, it's all an open book, it's just how you vandalize. That seems to be like the advice that the Fanning is giving to Rogers in this. So I wonder if that's actually Tim is actually, because he's the guy who wrote Hi-Fi Way and Ali Daily, and he's the Paul McCartney of the Australian music scene at the time or whatever. And he's kind of writing from the perspective of someone who wants to be him and be like, oh, it's all right, you'll get there. Like, it's all an open book. It's just how you fit. Like, it's kind of, it's a song about being second fiddle, but also being, don't be pessimistic about that. Be optimistic, because your luck can change. You can, it's all an open book. It's just how you vandalize. Like, you can, you can make it your own if you choose to, get on with it and do some cool shit. At least that's how I was kind of, I'd never always liked this song, but I'd never really kind of dug into what the specifics of the lyrics. And that was my kind of, one semester of psychology takeaway.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. For me, I'd always thought of it as a song that's kind of framed around like late teens, early 20s, when you're kind of, I guess, getting into, in his case, like the music scene, and watching someone else do it and wondering how do they pull it off so easily? How does it work so easily for them? And so I think it's kind of has that vibe that you get when you're a teenager, where I kind of referenced it before, where it just seems so much easier for someone else or other people, where why is it such a struggle for me, like, to do whatever, you know, to look cool or to, you know, play guitar or whatever, but for them they just do it so effortlessly. So that's the what I get, especially I guess from the first line and other lines of the song. And then like there's references to being a teenager about, you know, weekend blitz on the dicks that just whistle the tune. And so that's where I get the sense that it's more a late teen, early 20s kind of thing about how do you become the person you want to be. I think you've referenced it in your other podcast that you do, Juicy Ruins, which I recommend highly, where in your teens and early 20s, you're kind of trying on different masks and like, who am I? Who is the person that I want to be? And you get to a point in your 30s, like, okay, well, I've tried on all the masks and this is actually the person that I am. But in your 20s, you're like, who am I? Why did I say that? And then you're looking at other people like, they seem to have it all together. How do they work it out so easily? Like, they seem so assured. They've got everything going. Like, they, you know, dressing up cool. You know, how do they find that kind of style? You know, how did it come so easy? Like, what did I miss? Where was I on that day that
you're slapping your knees on the bus, mate?
That's right, I was thigh slapping. So yeah, that's what I get from that tune.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot more sense. Sorry, Bernard Fanning, you're out. Yeah, it does. It's cool. It seems like he's talking to younger Timmy almost to be like, you'll figure it out, mate. Or it kind of never ends. The trying to figure out what to do and how to fucking make it your own. But that's the album. Post-album, what do you like? I guess my note here, I touched on what I said before, that, and this was in like a tiny snippet of the, not the Owly Daily You Are My audio doc, but the audio doc that came out a couple months ago.
Yeah,
that's it. And where they just kind of did like 5 minutes on each album and little replaying some interviews at the time. And Kingsmill was saying, interviewing Tim Rogers at the time and saying like, oh yeah, this is, what do you think about this album? And Tim was like, yeah, I think it's our best stuff yet. And, you know, it's just, it comes out of like being on the road for a long time and the kind of, the grime and the grit and the exhaustion that probably comes with being a touring rock and roll band. And so, yeah, that kind of springs to mind that they were like seemingly happy with the tunes. And it seemed like kind of just a autobiographical of their experiences being on the road. And to go back to the title thing, I'm a little, I've got a theory that you can be, this isn't self-titled, but it's kind of like in the ballpark of like doing something that like, I don't know, the White Album or Metallica's Black Album or something like that, where you're kind of, you're trying to do something a little, I guess you'd call it like minimalist, where you're like removing something to try and do something. And so I think it works in a way, because I think it is just it is a departure from the concept record thing of Ali Daily, and it works on that meta level. But I think just for it gets a little bit lost in a sense, this album, because of the title, I think. And so I'm just wondering, like, if would the world have interpreted this or remember this album differently if it had a different title? So again, it's a 5% gripe, but anyway, this is just me kind of like retrospectively just thinking about kind of how the band seemed to appraise it, and then what happened critically with the band afterwards.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, because often an easy way to name an album is just name it after one of the songs. So you could choose one of the songs, you know, you could have What I Don't Know About You could have been a good one. Vandalism could have been a good one.
FTK
could have been a good one. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, I think overall, like I said at the top, I have such a personal relationship with this album that I find it hard to be too objective about it. But yeah, listening to it, I was trying to be objective over the last couple of weeks. I do see, I guess, some of it, the limitations that I hadn't seen in the past. That's been an interesting ride. But like you said, it's not about the songs. The songs are incredible. And if anything, there's maybe the way it was recorded or some of the songs are maybe semi-subdued because of maybe the vibe they were going for or whatever. But the songs themselves are immaculate. It's... I think quality-wise, it's up there with the songs themselves, up there with any other batch of songs that they've done. I'm really looking forward to getting to the next albums over the next few weeks. But I think when we get to the end, we'll say it as a bunch of songs. Number Four Record, had a great mix of rockers and ballads, jewels and bullets, if you will.
Defos. And I know this album hit number one on the ARIA charts. Is there anything of note that you can think of that's worth mentioning in respect to like critical reception or what happened with the tour of this this record? Anything you think you want to add in?
Not that comes immediately to mind, but yeah, there was the third number one in a row, which I think was the first time an Australian band had achieved three number ones in a row, number one albums in a row. I think it's been done subsequently, and it's pretty easy to get a number one record these days, but that was a big achievement back then. And when I say it's pretty easy to get a number one record these days, it's all relative. But yeah, I think that was a pretty big achievement. And I'm just, picking up snippets from interviews over the years, seems in hindsight to be a kind of tough time for the band, perhaps. And so as we travel from Ali Daily to number four and into the next episode, Dress Me Slowly, I think that's an interesting kind of subtext to what we're all talking about. So, yeah, from an analytical point of view, it's interesting. But I do want to mention just quickly before we finish up, some of the B-sides from this record. There was a live album that came out subsequently, I think in 1999, Saturday Night Round 10. I want to mention some of the B-sides on the bonus CD from that record, because we probably won't do an episode on Saturday Night Round 10, but with that release came a bonus CD-ROM, which housed a bit of a doco of those gigs. So you put the disc in your PC, you watch the CD-ROM and you can see a bit of a doco. It was very short. And then when you put the disc in your CD player, it's genius, out came five brilliant bonus tracks. I'm pretty sure they were B-sides from the number four sessions because they had some horns and it was a similar vibe to some of those tunes. And I just want to mention them because they are amazing songs, all five of them, particularly the first few. And they're really polished as well. Most B-sides, you know, show promise to kind of fizzle at some point, but these are, they could have easily ended up on an album. So check them out if you can. The tracks are Useless Information, Have You Plumb Gone and Given Up on Me, Bring the Old Sun Down, You Want It So Bad, and The Choices That I've Made. You know, once again, you're my B-sides, Die For.
Sweet. So that was Saturday Night, round 10 that you're referring to, right?
That's right.
Oh, interesting. Oh, wow. So those ones that, oh, here we go. I'm on Wiki right now. So, oh, sweet. Ignorance and Vodka was CD-ROM feature. Wow. Yeah. That is Inside Baseball. Sweet.
CD-ROM. It was technological genius. I had no idea. So you put it in the computer, it plays the CD-ROM. You put it in the CD player, it plays songs. Incredible.
I remember being a young music fan and then you would hear a B-side that you really liked. And I just the indignation that I would feel, I felt like writing a letter to the record label, dear sir/madam, whoever thought it would be a good idea to put this as a B-side instead of on the main album so it could have reached a wider audience. Like I would, B-sides always used to frustrate because I would initially there would be the the very kind of like hipster, yeah, this is cool, I discovered this, this is just for me, and some other kind of like select weirdos across suburbs in Australia. But then then that would very quickly be overtaken with like, nah, they're doing themselves a disservice here. This should have been on the main album. They should have done a double album. Like I would just be extremely frustrated by some B-sides decisions. So that's cool to know that they're got five more.
Hey, while I remember as well, you mentioned that You're My J-Files that came out a couple of months ago. I think people can still download it. It's funny to hear because Tim has obviously had a lot, and the band have had a lot of interviews with Richard Kingsmill over the years, and like it starts from the early 90s. You know, I think this documentary goes probably to the mid 2010s or something. And you, like Richard Kingsmill voice, it sounds the same throughout, but you can see, you can hear Tim's voice change throughout. So it's like, and then the next album's like, and then it's like, you know, it's kind of, you hear the lifestyle that's kind of accumulated over the years with his interviews in those particular, in that particular doc. It's a really cool part of it.
Yeah, there's a really funny part in that J-Files where Tim Rogers is talking about like his producer or something, saying, they're really, really nice guys. And he's like, I feel like George R. Martin talking about the Beatles here. They're just lovely chaps. I haven't mentioned chaps yet. So that's worth a listen. But all right, to close things out, it's a medal ceremony time. Gold, silver, and bronze. I'm not sure if you've done your homework, Jono.
I always forget.
Oh, come on, mate. That's no excuse. We're even for me bailing on you, making you wake up at 6:30 a.m. 2 weeks ago. All right, so I'll kick us off while you kind of
no worries.
You do some jazz hands and figure out what you're going to pick. But bronze for me, I'm going to go the close-up and Vandalism for my bronze medal. Silver and gold, it's really a toss-up. It's a dead heat, but I purely probably just because I can listen, I'm going to go silver, heavy heart, gold, junk. Mainly just because like heavy heart is very much like a self-sourcing pudding of a song. It's a very much a sometimes food. I can't have it too much. Yeah, otherwise, I will become a heavy heart myself. So but it's junk. I can always throw it on. And there's often, maybe it's, I often feel like a piece of junk, but I can turn things around with the right rock and roll number. So that's my podium. Jono, how are you looking?
That's a high quality podium. all right, I'm good. I'm good to go. I'm going to go bronze, plans. You know, we're in the suburbs at a
that was Saturday my fourth
party. Yeah. Yep. Great tune. Silver, I'll go cream in the croc. This is this one is the one I go to these days as my most kind of favorite rock and tune on this album. And then, yeah, gold, no surprises, heavy heart, really just because of the life-altering power that this song has imparted on me. So it's plans, it's cream in the croc, it's heavy heart for me.
Heavy heart is the crusty old tenured professor who has done enough time that it'll never get kicked out of your the institution that lives inside John O'Duncan. But all right, brother, we did it. Number four record in the bag. Stay tuned, anonymous listener, for next episode, which will be Dress Me Slowly, the introduction of David Lane to the band, which will be fun. And in the episode description or the YouTube description, we're going to have a little email address. I noticed the other day that there's a little contraption that allows people to leave a voice message. So maybe we'll set one of those up if you want to slag us off and criticize our selections or commentary or personal life stories. that would be cool. But all right, Jules and Bullets, signing out.
Do we have a scorecard for the Jules versus Bullets on this one? I've got 12 mil.
Yeah, no, I think the solo in What I Don't Know About You was kind of like we had to go to VAR for that one, but in fact it did cross the line and it was another goal. So yeah, we've got our 12 zip to those pesky Jules. They can't help themselves.
Now, all looking forward to Dress Me Slowly. I just want to put out a bit of a teaser. This is a bit of, I don't know, clickbait, if you will, in the pod world. There may be, I may communicate something controversial next week on Dress Me Slowly. Ooh. I won't say any more. I may not, because I might chicken out.
Give me and the anonymous listener one more word. You can't just say that. You've got to give us like a word of a hint.
B-sides.
Ooh, okay. All right. I know what I'm going to be doing for the next week. Deep dive time. All right, bro. Cool. All right. Till next time.